From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, inviting you to join us as we meet our guests and encourage you to be part of the discussion. Our topic today is gang violence in our region. After all the community conversations, what have we learned? Are there new best practices that we're implementing? What's already working that we might expand? And where can we improve? Gang violence and the steady conversion of at-risk children into gang members is an issue that's on the rise across the country. Gun violence within Wilmington city limits has crept into neighborhoods that haven't previously seen this kind of activity. And now Senate Bill 594 is making its way through the legislature. Entitled Omnibus Justice Amendments, it would allow tougher sentences for those carrying illegal firearms. Some law enforcement officials have hailed the proposal as an important tool on the enforcement end. But the enforcement piece is only one component of what community leaders say must be a multifaceted solution. It was near the end of last year that Wilmington City Manager Sterling Cheatham spearheaded a series of public forums to address the spike in gun-related violence that captured local headlines. Compiling conclusions from those conversations, Cheatham called the key recommendations some of the most reasonable thoughts from active community participants who have their ears to the ground and their hearts set on change. On today's Coastline, we'll explore some of those recommendations. We'll also find out what local law enforcement officials are doing on the preventive front. We'll hear from local NAACP leader Deborah Dix Maxwell, Link's Frankie Roberts on what's working and what we could be doing. Joining us right now in the studio is New Hanover County Sheriff Ed McMahon. Welcome, Sheriff McMahon.
Thank you, Rachel. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. Also with us in the studio is Program Coordinator Christy Williams with the Sheriff's Department. Hi, Christy.
Hey, good afternoon.
During the next hour, you're invited to join our discussion. Is your neighborhood afflicted by violent crime? Do you know someone involved in a gang? Do you work with at-risk children? Or with one of the many organizations working on the solution. If you have a comment or question, give us a call at 910-343-1138. Send us an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. Sheriff McMahon, why does it seem as though we're seeing more violence now? On the front page of today's Star News, there was a story about a mother who had lost her 17-year-old son to gang violence. It seems to be dominating the headlines. How would you characterize the level of gang activity in New Hanover County right now?
Right now, well, as everyone knows, it has been very high, very active, and we've had a lot of problems, a lot of challenges. I would say right now, and you hate to say that it's not there, it's quiet, it's quieter right now. We've been doing a lot of initiatives. We've got a lot of the violent gang members in our jail. So we've been doing some very proactive things, initiatives with the Wilmington Police Department to make a dent in the violence in the gangs.
And you brought your program coordinator, Christy Williams, with you. But before we get to what she is spearheading right now,
Yes. Tell
me, is there a difference between gang violence and youth gun violence? Or are we talking about the same thing? Are those interchangeable terms?
I would say they're about interchangeable. So, you know, if you're going to – the youth, a lot of our youth are involved in the gang. That's the target of the gangs. And the natural elements from that are your gun violence and your drugs.
You have a gang task force.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The goal of the gang task force is we want to implement a combination. We've talked about you can't arrest away the problem. We want to implement a combination of prevention, intervention, diversion, and suppression strategies to address all the different factors. Now, back starting probably last summer, we had a real spike in violent behavior. So at that point, we really focused a lot on suppression. Suppression would be the enforcement part of it. You know, we were going in and we were enforcing. We were in there, the presence, we didn't really have a choice. We had to go in there and kind of calm things down a little bit. And with that came a lot of gun violence, both on law enforcement and on the criminal element.
And at that point, you also beefed up your presence, didn't you, and collaborated more with Wilmington Police Department?
We did. And I'll tell you, working with our police chief, Ralph Evangelos, has been just a great, great thing for the community, for him and I working together, the agencies working together, sharing information. Everybody knows how successful the downtown unit has been, and now we've got the Housing Authority unit in task force in there, and they are making a difference. The violence is typically in inner city type areas, but the majority of the people in these, the housing authorities in these areas, are good people. They're in there, and you know, just the reality of where we're at and different things that they've, circumstances they've had to deal with, but that this is where they're at, but they're good people.
And so you're saying that the violence in those, in those housing authority areas is being perpetrated by non-residents?
Absolutely. So the majority of it is people coming into these areas where all the people are at, where they're looking for things. They're looking for, you don't have father figures, you don't have security, you don't have family support. So the really hardened, violent criminals are coming into these areas, recruiting for gang members, coming in with drugs. So with the housing, with the officers in, day in and day out, the community has to trust law enforcement. So that was one hurdle we had to get through. We're here. We don't want to just come in, react, arrest a bunch of people, and then leave, because this is your home, your environment. So by us being in there with this combined unit, we've told these good folks, hey, we care about you. We're going to be in here. We're going to stay in here. Now we're getting to know the residents. They're getting to trust us. We're building relationships with the children, with the adults. They're trusting us. Now we know who doesn't belong there. The Housing Authority has been great to work with us in getting trespass lists out. And then if people knowingly violate these, then they have to move. So it's been very successful.
Christy Williams, you're program coordinator for something called Elements, which is part of the new Hanover County Sheriff's Department.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us about that.
Elements is a part of our gang task force. We were originated as a grant about 8 or 9 years ago. The grant was written for gang specific. So the children that we served were either gang involved or at risk of. Just this past year, we expanded to youth violence. What we were seeing is that there were a lot of kids that we were missing. There were kids who were younger, kids who were victims, not just perpetrators.
And when you say kids that you were missing, you mean kids that were slipping through the cracks, at-risk kids.
Absolutely.
Who were then going on to a life in a gang.
Yes, ma'am. Or we were getting them at a point where they were so involved or so just older that we couldn't impact them in the way that we felt would be long-lasting. So this past year, we changed things up a little bit. We lowered the ages that we are targeting. We are now focusing more on 4th through 8th grade youth. And we are in the schools. We're in the community. We have two different parts of our program. One is referral-based. Family members, DSS, other agencies, the schools, they can refer kids to the program. They will get 6 months to a year with us where we are working with them one-on-one in their home setting, in the community, with group activities that we have and offer. And we also have a diversion program that started about a year ago in response to our SROs going into the elementary schools. And with this program—
And by SRO, you mean school resource officers who are able to observe the kids— And see where there might be potential for risk.
Yes. When Sandy Hook, the shooting happened, we went into, as law enforcement, into the elementary schools. And it really opened up our eyes to see what all was happening at such a young age. And we hadn't, to be honest, with the Elements program, we hadn't seen such young kids doing the crimes that we saw once the school resource officers got in there. And it was heartbreaking to see these kids who are protecting themselves or making mistakes or following their older siblings get involved in the court system at such a young age. So now they, instead of going through the court system, if it's a low-level first offense, they can come through our program and work with us instead of getting involved with the juvenile justice system and getting charged.
Thinking back to these community conversations that were spearheaded by Wilmington City Manager Sterling Cheatham, is there anything that the Sheriff's Department has learned from this? And quickly, we just have a couple of minutes left before we go to break. Anything that has caused you to change your ideas about your programs or?
Well, I think the biggest thing, and that was just such a great plan by our city manager to do that, it brought us all together in one area, in one room. A lot of people didn't even know that we had the prevention side, the Elements program and all that. We weren't aware of some of the things that were going on. A lot of good people trying to do separate things. And it's just like with the law enforcement. With everything, it's got to be community. So a big thing for me was being in the same area and having some tough conversations and getting over some trust issues and then saying, okay, bottom line, it's not about us as the adults. It's about our children. It's about the next generation. So what are we going to do to make a difference? And I think that, to me, has been huge. And now we have the Shaw Speaks building, which has put a lot of us together. Children are there, and a lot of law enforcement there also.
You've got Wilmington PD and also
Absolutely.
Sheriff's Department.
Yes.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Sheriff Ed McMahon, Program Coordinator Christy Williams, thank you for joining us today. Today we're talking about gang violence in our region. After a series of public forums on the issue, what have we learned, and are we doing anything that's working? When we come back, Deborah Dix Maxwell, president of the New Hanover County NAACP, will join us. The phones are now open. Give us a call at 910-343-1138. Send emails to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at coastlinehqr. This is Coastline. Welcome to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and joining me now in the studio is Deborah Dix Maxwell, president of the New Hanover County NAACP. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you.
We're talking about youth gun violence in our region, what we've learned after all the public discussions, what we're doing that's working, and what we still have to learn as a community. If you have a question, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. Deborah Dix Maxwell, you've said before that we are putting a lot of emphasis on law enforcement in terms of addressing this problem, and perhaps not enough resources into preventive programs. As a social worker, how do you account for the rise in youth gun violence in this area?
We have a lack of resources for our youth. We have diverse schools, and the fact that we have racially identifiable schools by people of color, of people not of color. We have schools that are identified by socioeconomic status. Until we come together and realize that the community is New Hanover County, not your neighborhood, in resolving issues and not saying, not in my backyard, we are not going to resolve anything.
Do you actually run up against that, the not in my backyard approach?
It's been prevalent, by the way. Districting is set up within the school system.
You really hold up the school system as one of the paradigms for how the community is viewed here. You're talking about segregation in the school system.
It is. And previously, I just spoke with someone who did not realize that schools were segregated 50 years ago to the point no matter where you lived, you were bussed into town to uphold the statutes of segregation.
Do you think that when it comes to gun violence in our young people, that fear is a factor in how we handle the problem?
Yes, and that fear has allowed people to push for our elected officials to provide financial funds for law enforcement, but they really have not pushed for financial funds for prevention and education for our youth.
There are so many resources out there. I mean, just when we spoke earlier, you named a number of programs, the Cape Fear Workforce Investment Act programs, Big Brothers, Big Buddies, the First 2,000 Days, Smart Start. With all these programs, are we not putting enough funding towards these programs? Are we not mobilizing our resources? Where's the missing piece?
Funding is part of the issue. Education still. Tomorrow night there'll be a program about the first 2,000 days presented to educate people about that, how important it is preventing the toxic stress that causes the violence that occurs with our youth.
You talk about toxic stress. What do you mean by that?
That's environmental factors. When a child is exposed to unsafe conditions, violence in the household, unstable housing, these things create problems later in a child's development. And that's why we need to start at the first day of life and sometimes preconceptionally to let parents know that there's support out there. We really don't support parents in the process of parenting like we should.
Preconceptually, you say, you're talking about pregnant women.
Yes. At pregnancy, to understand how to take care of your child, what forces you need to do, what resources you need. And we really don't, as a country, we applaud people who get degrees, but we don't applaud people who are effective parents or people who show how to do that.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about gun violence in our youth. If you live in an area that's afflicted by violent crime, or you're one of the many people in our area working with an organization seeking to address the problem, we'd like to hear from you. Joining us today to answer your questions, Deborah Dix Maxwell of the NAACP. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138. Send an email to coastline@whqr.org or just tweet us using coastlinehqr. Deborah Dix Maxwell, we talked about the first 2,000 days, and there's an organization called First 2,000 Days. Do I have that right? That's the name of the organization, I think. There are only 2,000 days between the time a baby is born and the time that baby goes to the first day of kindergarten. And there is a growing understanding that those days in between birth and kindergarten are critical. Why?
It impacts the child's development, how they will see things, respond, and the nurturing that occurs at that time is so critical for how they will be successful as an adult and imparting critical thinking skills to them.
What could we as a community be doing? You talked about funding. So we could certainly allocate more money towards some of these programs, but what are some of the other ways that our listeners might be able to participate in addressing this problem?
They can participate by educating themselves first about the first 2,000 days. It's inappropriate to ever scream in front of a child. A child at the age of two, until over the age of two, does not need to see a TV. Don't let it be your babysitter. There are a lot of simple things that we can do to encourage children. People can be mentors. There are formal and informal ways to do that.
Some of the factors during these community conversations that were identified as contributing to this problem, gun violence in our youth, absence of family structure was mentioned. You talked about getting in touch, accessing young pregnant women. How do we do that?
You can do that through outreach. Everyone who's pregnant is receiving prenatal care. So they can try through the clinic, the OB, or link with letting the health department know they have programs. If someone really wants to do something, it can be done.
One of the commonly identified factors also is the lack of a father or a strong male role model in a child's life. And just this morning, there was a front page article in the Star News about a woman grieving the loss of her 17-year-old son. She lost him to gang violence. And she pretty clearly identified the lack of a male figure in her son's life as one of the leading causes. What can the community do? How can we be proactive as a community?
We can be proactive as a community. Like I said, there are formal and informal ways. You have the Cape Fear Volunteer Center, 100 Black Men, through local churches that are going into the schools. Those are the formal ways. One could one-on-one see a little boy that just needs somebody in your next door if you pass the background check, I say, and work that way. It can be done, and it has to be done if we wish to restore this community.
We have Anne from Wilmington. Anne, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, Ms. Maxwell? I care a lot about this subject, and I fully understand and agree that primary factors are the lack of a good role model father in the home, and also the drug culture that we have here, and this provides some means of earning some money for these kids. But what I want to deal with is channeling their energy while giving them some skills and some direction and some good role models. We have a marvelous resource here. It's a natural resource. We have our river, our ocean, and our sounds. Boating, particularly sailing, is a structured activity that's a lot of fun. It provides competition when you have races. We have the community college, which provides boat building classes. We have the Y's, which can provide swimming lessons if the kids don't know how to swim. We have people with skills in the community who can help these young people, particularly the boys, but it also includes the girls, learn about sailing. It's a very exciting activity. And what I want to say is this. All of my children and grandchildren are sailors. They were trained this way at the Carolina Yacht Club and off at the Camp Seafarer in Seagull. Right now I have two grandchildren participate in that program. I go over there and I watch all these kids having a wonderful time and having leadership and learning skills and competing against each other. And you know what? There's not a black face in there.
And Anne, I have to say, you mentioned the yacht club, and yeah. I immediately thought, if I'm growing up in the inner mm-hmm. city, mm-hmm. how am I going to have access to a yacht club?
I'll tell you how. You don't have to be a member to participate in these programs. Anybody, any child, can participate in these sailing programs at the yacht club. Yet still, it's an all-white program, and I have spoken. My great-great uncle founded the yacht club. It was the first Commodore. Mm-hmm. I'm very familiar with it. This day and age, that should not be the case.
It should not be the case. You make an excellent point, and let's let Deborah Dix Maxwell
sure.
respond. Where Deborah Dix Maxwell? Where is the gap here? Why are we only seeing white faces at the yacht club?
Because it is a yacht club, and you are at a certain socioeconomic status in order to be a member. I appreciate your comments, but my first priority would be, if you're talking about something nautical, is that children of color learn to swim, that yacht club pay for swimming scholarships, because historically we're the ones who drown at the beach and are unable to swim.
Yeah, well, let me respond.
Yes, go ahead, Anne.
Yes. You do not, first of all, you do not have to be a club member to take the sailing program in the summer. Any child can take it. Of course, you have to pay for it, so we get to a financial aspect of it. A fund could be created, and this should not be from the yacht club, which would be providing the boats and the space and so on, and the training and the leadership, but in the community, a fund to pay the fees that every kid has to pay to participate in the program. You have, as I said, swimming lessons. You have to learn how to swim. Great, that's the first step. You can learn boat building. It's all there.
Right,
it's
right.
all there.
And thanks so much for your call. Deborah Dix Maxwell, there is something of a cultural gap, even if the financial issue was bridged. I'm just, you know, trying to put myself in a circumstance that would feel perhaps like a foreign country to me, a little daunting. Can you speak to that?
It would be, because there's a certain attire that's worn when you're in a nautical environment that maybe this child may not have, regardless of the scholarship. So that's why there's that immersion, why we need schools to be evenly balanced so children have that opportunity for that exposure. On a daily basis.
And she does make an excellent point mm-hmm. that the fact that all of the kids in that program are white, what does that say about where we are right now as a culture? We have an email from Sam Wortel. He says, I'd like to ask what's being done to hold parents accountable for the actions of their children. I feel that too much responsibility for raising our children is put on the public school system. We are charged with teaching our children how to be productive, responsible members of society. We, I think he means parents, and I feel that the biggest problem is a failure of parents to raise their children to respect all people, not just the people in their neighborhood and of their particular race. How do you respond?
We, unfortunately, society does put a lot of emphasis on the school system, but with the recent violence, a lot of criticism was directed towards parents. And one of the scriptures says, train up a child in the way he should go, and he shall not part from it. And I'm one of those children who did part the wrong way, but I found my way back. So you have to instill those values and morals and character at an early age. That's why that's so that important, because teenagers do divert, and they do come back.
As we know, and there are teenagers who don't fall into a life of gang violence, but look back on the adolescent years and think it's incredible that I survived that. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about gun violence in the youth in our community. If you live in an area afflicted by violent crime, if you're one of the many people working in one of the organizations seeking to address the problem, we'd like to hear from you at 910-343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. Deborah Dix Maxwell from the NAACP, other elements that have been identified as contributing to this problem are racism, media, lack of accountability, which I think Sam was just referring to in his email. But let's talk about racism for a moment. How does that play into this issue? How does racism in this region, does it perpetuate the problem?
It's perpetuated by the fact that it's targeted, even sometimes in the media, that only young black males are getting into trouble. It's not that. They're the ones who don't have the funds to have a private attorney to not get out of jail easily. They're sent into the juvenile justice system versus someone else who's sent to counseling. So it distorts the statistics. It distorts what's really happening. The teacher is more susceptible to sending a black male to suspension versus a white male where the parent may come and advocate, because they're like me. They're a working parent and can't afford to take off every day for every child.
What do you think that your average person in this community doesn't really understand about this issue here and what contributes to it? If you could shine a light on an attitude that you think is particularly misguided.
I think there's a lot of blame thrown on the parents, but it's a systemic problem. It's not just the parents. It's not just the schools. It's all of us. It's how it's perceived. It's how it's been written in the media when it first happened, to give that aura of fear that allowed all this funding to go towards law enforcement and none towards prevention.
Well, tell us, how did that emerge in the media? Can you give me an example of something that you've seen in the paper or heard on the air and thought, that's not right. You shouldn't be telling the story that way.
Whenever it's told, when they first identify, when stuff occurs, an incident, you know that it's a black male because they'll say that. But they won't just say if it's someone of another, of not black, they'll just say a male, so-and-so generally. Just short things, or in this neighborhood, making the neighborhood sound bad when it actually is not, because there are good people everywhere. And they're a little bit of bad everywhere, too.
You talked earlier about parenting skills and how important that is. Can you talk a little more? Because you have said that we assume that we have to get a degree to specialize in a certain area, in a certain career choice, but we don't have to go to school to be a parent.
And we should go to school to be a parent. It's one of the most important things one will ever do, and people never a lot of times seek additional information on how to be an effective parent, because it's something you do every day of your life. My daughter's an adult. I'm still parenting. And people get offended when they say, oh, you want me to take a parenting class? I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But yet you go get degrees and paperwork for everything else you do. Mm-hmm. And self-improvement for your skill.
And so you're saying that should just be part of the standard curriculum, how to be a parent. Certain things. What you said that you yourself went down the wrong road at one point. Can you talk about what brought you back briefly?
My church, my faith, the love of my family, and the support of my family.
And how did you wind up going down that wrong road?
You're just young. It's nothing that was criminal or anything, but you just make sometimes immature choices because you're at that age of immaturity. So I can understand about the youth who get in that. It's not intentional always, but but by the grace of God, here I am. And so therefore we need to have them have that supportive community of church and of family so that they'll understand that there's someone there when you decide I want to do what I should do that's appropriate.
Just in the minute or so that we have left, what is the thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with about this problem? If you could really open up their eyes to understanding something, what would that be?
The community is New Hanover County. We as a county must come together and support all of our youth, provide recreational resources throughout the county for them, and support whatever endeavors positive agencies that are already doing in this community for our youth. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. Just go back and do like we used to do.
Deborah Dix Maxwell of the New Hanover County NAACP, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Today we're talking about gun violence in our youth, in our region. What we've learned after all the community conversations. Coming up right after this break, Frankie Roberts of the nonprofit Leading Into New Communities, or LINC, joins the discussion. And we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 343-1138. You can send emails to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with us now in the studio is Frankie Roberts, Executive Director of LINC, the acronym for Leading Into New Communities. Welcome, Frankie.
Thank you for inviting us, Rachel.
We're happy to have you here. We're talking about gang violence today, or youth gun violence in our region, and we're going to talk about the use of those terms in a second. We're talking about what we're learning after all the public discussions, what's working and what isn't. If you know someone involved in a gang, if you live in an area that's been plagued by gun violence, or if you're involved in one of the many local organizations that's working hard to address the problem, we'd like to hear from you. Call us at 343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. or tweet us using CoastlineHQR. Frankie Roberts, tell us about LINC, Leading Into New Communities. What is the mission of the organization?
Well, the mission of the organization is twofold. One is we provide residential reentry for people who have been formerly incarcerated. We have a residential facility at 222 Division Drive where our capacity is we're able to house 20 men and 20 women who find themselves coming out of prison and homeless. We also provide what we call academic support, employment training, and also a curriculum on teaching the hidden rules to middle-class culture for African-American males 16 to 21. So that's a twofold mission of our organization.
You said you teach a course on the rules.
Hidden rules.
The hidden rules to navigating middle-class culture.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, certainly like anything or any system, there are rules and then there are hidden rules. But we don't normally think of the hidden rules of middle class culture as a system within itself, especially when the young men we serve, which sometimes I even take for granted, that the rules that it required to be successful wasn't wrapped into the fabric of their upbringing. So what we have done through a process is ensure that these young men understand what those hidden rules look like, what they are, and also where to look around the corner and see them so that they can be successful in that system.
For those listeners who have no idea what we're talking about, give me an example of a hidden rule, something that an at-risk kid might not grow up understanding, but he needs to be taught.
Okay, I use a pretty basic one. I'm in a classroom. Got a young man that grew up in the inner city, and a person walks in the classroom and asks this young man, how long ago did your teacher leave? And the young man out the inner city would probably say, she been gone. Mm-hmm. And which we would consider in that environment improper English. But what a teacher would typically want to do is ask that young lad to restate that. And then and if you restate it in proper English, we would say the teacher left 15 minutes ago.
So you're really talking about some cultural differences here.
Cultural differences, because if the teacher left 15, 20 minutes ago, he been gone is just as accurate as she left 15 minutes ago. But those are just rules that I'm not going to be affirmed or accepted in that environment if I can't speak the King's English very eloquently. And what the average person wouldn't think that was a rule. One of our young men would say, Mr. Roberts, why would that matter? That doesn't make me a bad person.
Sure. But it's the perception about
Correct.
That child. So we're talking about a cultural issue. Are we also calling this a racial issue?
Oh, absolutely.
So is there training for teachers that could be a part of the bridging of this cultural gap or racial gap that we know we have in this area?
Well, yeah, but let's look at it from a different perspective, because I know teachers get bogged down and sometimes disregarded when you use the word cultural competence, diversity, and that. What we call it from where we sit is professional development. We think that teachers, if they can understand professional development or rules that govern the so-called ghetto where a lot of students would come from, because it's a system just like the school system, judicial system, any other system, corporate American systems, the so-called ghetto, and I say so-called, is a system also. And in order to be effective with individuals that come from that reality, a teacher needs the professional development to understand that system also.
We have an email from Christine. She says, years ago, I worked with at-risk 12 and 13-year-olds in the inner city of Kansas City. The young boys in particular were drawn into gangs because they needed a sense of belonging. Some of them had a chaotic home situation without positive role models, no one to help them do schoolwork or take them to after-school recreational opportunities. The gangs offered them something to do and someplace to be. We need to give our children positive places to belong. Is this what you're seeing right here in Wilmington, Frankie?
Yes, I would say to a degree, yeah, that is what we're seeing. You know, you have to give young men, a youth, certainly something to do. But I think we have to give them something to do, which is learn by doing. And doing positive things, being able to have access and opportunities, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Students and children will be successful every time all day long if that's the expectation of the community. And when we look at and I try to move away from the at-risk word, but I try to use the word youth who haven't been able to understand their promise and their purpose and their passion. And we see that primarily with the African Americans we serve.
And talking about just terms that we're using, we've been talking about gang violence and we've been talking about gun violence in the young community. But you have a beef with the term gang violence.
Yeah, because it's a code word for black kids doing gangbangers, thugs. It's a code word. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I take issue with that. I think that, you know, again, more positive terms, because, you know, if you see five or six young men on the corner, the perception that the community have is there's those old gangbangers, especially if they have locks in their hair or sagging pants, a white T-shirt.
So are you saying they're not gang members?
You wouldn't know if unless you engage or into a conversation. Or if I'm a person who had been reformed from a street capitalism lifestyle, how would you know if you never engaged that person and pretty much treated all black guys the same? And let me just make this one point. Okay, I was raised in Wilmington in the inner city, went to a private school K through 8th that taught mastery. So when I went into the public school, Rolling Rice and Hargett, I was extremely smart. It's just the reality.
When you say the school taught mastery, what do you mean by that?
It taught you to master everything you did, math, reading, science. So when I landed—
It taught you a way of approaching
absolutely,
a subject.
Consistently. Okay. And if you had any weakness, they was going to ensure that that weakness became a strength. And so— But because I was out of the inner city and used to go through that line, lunch line with the free lunch ticket, the teachers and administrators treated me like what their experience has been as a gangbanger, where that wasn't my reality. And so I got lost and had to develop a subculture to survive and become mediocre so that the teachers would be happy that this young kid, this poor out of the inner city, is a dummy like we perceived that he was.
So you're saying when you were in school, you were safer. You felt safer. You felt rewarded for mediocrity.
Absolutely.
Instead of excellence.
No, that's
excellence was threatening is what you're saying.
Excellence was threatening to teachers and administrators from a poor kid. Now, my friends who were doctors and lawyers' children, they weren't treated that way. It was as though they were expected to be smarter.
How does that? That's one of the ways that race plays into the perpetuation of kids going into that kind of a lifestyle. What are some of the other ways that racism is encountered by African Americans in this community and feeding into that cycle? I mean, what are the things that you think white people just don't understand?
That the perception of a black versus a white, because when we talk about gangbangers, and as you looked at today's paper, 70% of the gang members, they say, are black. So just by that mention, that means that blacks between 16 and 25 typically can't be businessmen, entrepreneurs, successful working young men. Because again, when we're talking about gang members, we aren't talking about white men between 16 and 25. So I think that's how it plays itself out, so that I don't get the same opportunity and the same access, because when I walk up the street, I'm already put in a category as an undesirable, and then law enforcement then focuses on isolation, containment, and control versus liberation, freedom, and opportunity for those young men.
And there's a term that you've used before. On the flip side of that, you've used the term white privilege.
Oh, good God Almighty.
What does that mean?
Well, there are certain privileges in America that is merited to a person when they're white. And that is, you know, the systems are designed around the success of white men, then in white females, then black females, and then black men are typically at the bottom. That's typically the pecking order. And I don't say that to be crass or disrespectful. I say that as being the reality that we see. And so if I walk into a bank, if I see all white tellers, typically, if I see white bankers that are typically male, obviously if a like person or the kinship to being white, when I walk in that institution, it's going to be more embracing and receiving of. And I just think we have to be a little bit more intention to tear down the artificial barriers like color and gender that separates us, so that we can kind of cross those lines to improve and enhance everyone's success.
But when you say tear down those barriers, you're not talking about homogenization, because there has been a lot of talk about how schools in New Hanover County are rather segregated. And And yet, back in the days of segregation, Williston, for example, was considered to be a very good school. That was an African-American school.
Yes, that was
that
right.
And you say there's something to that because these kids weren't being taught to be white.
Correct. Correct. And let me qualify that. Williston, being one of the greatest schools under the sun, was ranked top five in the nation of all schools, black or white. But it's never expressed or embraced that way. So here's a black school from a little town like Wilmington that's ranked in the nation that's not affirmed. So I think it's something that's said for black pride during that time, which was our practice. So when you desegregated, integrated, you know, we can take issue with what really happened. Why would you close a black school that was ranked top five in the nation and make those kids enter a white system that was not designed for their success versus send some white kids to Williston and some white kids to Hanover? And we have to look at it. It was done, in my humble opinion, intentionally, and look at the psychological impact that that had on black students to go from a majority environment into a minority environment where the teachers and administrators really didn't like them anyway.
I want to get to this email from D. Harold Green. He's the author of The Rites of Passage for Males. And he says, if you do not help these young boys and men to get good paying jobs, then they'll continue to use gangs to socialize and earn income. Dropout rates and unemployment rates ages 16 to 24 in Wilmington are appalling. We are a national online job skills training program headquartered here in Wilmington, okay, that trains trainers nationwide to teach at-risk males life skills, self-esteem, and self-sufficiency. We have over 750 master trainers nationwide on, okay, he goes on to talk about the online job skills training program. Tired of the talk, let's do something. How would you respond to him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a good approach.
You also have mentioned there's these subtle differences in language. We've talked about white privilege, and I think that's something that a lot of white people, perhaps a term, are not familiar with and probably also not aware. As Dr. Timothy Tyson, the author of Blood Done Sign My Name from Duke University, has said, fish don't necessarily know that they're wet.
Correct.
But what is your final thought? If you could just share one illuminating thought with the community about addressing this problem, what would that be?
That would be engaging more conversations and be receiving of each other's perspective and be willing to step and sit in each other's shoes so that you can truly build a relationship, because at the end of the day, relationships is how we cure all of these challenges and differences.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Frankie Roberts of Link, Deborah Dix Maxwell with the New Hanover County NAACP, and New Hanover County Sheriff Ed McMahon and his program coordinator, Christy Williams. Thanks to all of our listeners and those who called, emailed, and tweeted during the conversation. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Join us next week. We're talking about public education in North Carolina. Where are we headed after state leaders make their budget decisions during this short session? That's next week on Wednesday, July 16th at 2 p.m. here on WHQR 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Ken Campbell. Associate producers are Bob Workman and Lindsay McGrath. Our technical coordinators are George Scheibner and Lan Nichols. Our music editor is Bob Workman. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of our listeners and our guests, and not necessarily of WHQR Public Radio or our licensee, Friends of Public Radio, Incorporated. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.